Ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege to welcome to the Salieri Report an investigative reporter and American historian who I've been following and admiring for many years, Sally Denton. Sally is her work is very interesting because her articles and her books really cross the gamut between both popular culture and academia. We're talking about someone who writes very serious history, but it's also enormously entertaining if you want to understand the deeper story of what's going on in America and how we got here. I first came into contact with her work on MENA, Arkansas, and the allegations of narcotics trafficking in MENA, Arkansas. And that evolved into Bluegrass Conspiracy, a story of narcotics trafficking and organized crime in Kentucky, which, Sally, you're going to laugh when you hear this. When I first tried to buy it, was the single most expensive book to buy used on Amazon.
Oh, wow.
And then she's got a
following.
You've got a very wealthy cult following. And then she's got a remarkable book called The Money and the Power, which is a history of Las Vegas with co-author Roger Morris. But she publishes at sallydenton.com, and she also has a Twitter feed. I should mention she's the director of literary nonfiction at the Black Mountain Institute at the University of Nevada, which I consider to be a very prestigious position in the world of literary nonfiction. Anyway, so an extremely serious and extremely accomplished investigator, reporter, and American historian. So I almost fell off my chair when I saw her new book, The Profiteers, Bechtel and the Men Who Built the World. Bechtel is arguably the leading construction company in the world and a very important government contractor and a member in good standing of the deep state. And it's very rare that you get serious investigation and treatment of Bechtel. So it's a marvelous opportunity to learn about that company, but also a very important part of understanding our government and our governance system. So, Sally, welcome to the Salieri Report. You have to start by telling us, how in the world did you come to write The Profiteers?
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. As you said, this is not my first rodeo. This is actually my eighth book, and I write narrative nonfiction, narrative history, investigative history, but this came to me kind of out of context, except that I grew up in Boulder City, Nevada, which was the company town for the signature project of Bechtel in the 1930s, Hoover Dam. So it was very much a household name to me. And it was amazing to me how few people in America have ever heard of the company once I started researching. This book took 4 years to research and write. And when I first started it, of course, I knew about Hoover Dam. But even when I started the book, I really thought they were just kind of a big, you know, the first mega company of the American West. It was Hoover Dam was a massive undertaking. At a moment when there was not a company in America, in the East or the West, that was a construction company in America that was capable of basically damming the Colorado River there at the border of Nevada and Arizona, and creating electric power for Southern California, irrigation throughout the California and Arizona and basically making cities like Las Vegas and Los Angeles even possible. So six companies came together. They were called the six companies. There were actually eight, but they called them six companies they were named for the Chinese Tong, the kind of organized crime governing body in San Francisco for Chinese disputes. And all these companies were Western, and Bechtel took the lead and basically was the lead contractor, and Hoover Dam became their signature project. But even when I started researching this book 5 years ago, 4 years ago, I still thought that it was going to be the story of a mega behemoth American construction and engineering firm. I had no idea that, in fact, they were building stuff throughout the entire world, throughout around the globe, and basically on every continent and almost every country in the world. So it was a massive, the other thing I found that was really kind of striking was that while it was not a household name in the United States, and there were reasons for that, it's one of the largest privately held companies in America, and they have gone to great lengths for 75 years to make sure nobody's heard about them, but they are very much a household name throughout the world, especially in the Middle East
and
Africa.
One of the things that makes that's quiet possible is that they're family, essentially family-controlled and family-managed.
They've been family-controlled since the beginning. It started with Warren Bechtel, Dad, they called him, who was the, you know, basically he was an old rough-and-tumble road grader from Oklahoma who, you know, gets one of the first government contracts in California for road construction. And again, this is one of the great ironies of many ironies of this family and this story is that, you know, they are rabidly anti-government and basically owe their founding and their complete five generation of livelihood to government contracts. But they came, you know, it was it presented challenges for me for uncovering a lot because it is because it's private nature. They're not required to file filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission and have other levels of transparency that other mega companies in America would have or multinationals throughout the world.
Now, one of the things is their rise as a construction firm, a lot of it came out of energy, both nuclear and oil and gas. And I was always, one of my favorite Bechtel stories is in a story of Eisenhower getting wildly angry because Bechtel lobbied Eisenhower to try and get the ability to build and own nuclear bombs within the corporation.
Yeah, for their own personal construction, for the bomb, you know, tunnels and stuff.
Well, that's why I'm so, we'll get to it later, but your story about them taking over the nuclear labs, I almost thought, well, I guess it took them 50 years.
Yeah, I mean.
They don't necessarily own them, but they're getting close.
For a long time. But that's another, you know, that was another shocking thing to me. I had no idea when I started this book that they were basically managing the entire nuclear weapons complex in America, and I don't think most Americans have any idea still that they are. But they,
I don't think
they
do
under
either.
George W. Bush, there was the entire nuclear weapons facilities and nuclear weapons complex was privatized, essentially. And so with Bechtel at the helm. So they're managing Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore, and you know, they're doing a major cleanup at Hanford. And, you know, I mean, they have been, as you said, I mean, since before Eisenhower, they have been angling to get nukes in private hands and under their control for a very long time. And, you know, they managed to finally do that.
One of the things, clearly they've had a very important role for many decades in the Middle East because of their role in energy and construction both. And we'll get to the war in Iraq, but one, I thought your book did a marvelous job of explaining what a turbocharging the Reagan years gave to the size and power of Bechtel and the and their involvement in not just serving government but really driving government policy. Maybe if you could talk about what happened coming into the Reagan years and what I call Schultz-Weinberger and the rise of Riley.
Right. This is I trace 75 years of this company, but it really begins with, it comes out of Hoover Dam and Warren Bechtel dies kind of mysteriously in the Soviet Union supposedly having been invited there by Stalin to advise on construction projects. But then it goes from there into, you know, the run up to World War II and Bechtel gets into shipbuilding after, Stephen Bechtel, one of Warren's sons ends up taking over the company. And so I trace the rise of Bechtel under Stephen Bechtel, who becomes partners with a guy named John McCone, who had worked for Consolidated Steel, which provided the steel to Hoover Dam, which was a huge, I mean, massive contract, as you can imagine. And so for a while, the company was actually Bechtel McCone. And then McCone decided to go into government instead. And this is the beginning of I argue that Bechtel really designed the revolving door that has become pro forma in business today, but it was not pro forma back then in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and that it was with McCone, who goes on to become the head of the Atomic Energy Commission, that leads to Bechtel's many contracts to build the first nuclear reactors in the United States. And then McCone goes on to become director of CIA under John F. Kennedy, and which further opens the floodgates for great contracts for Bechtel in intelligence work, and particularly throughout the Middle East, where, you know, there are the beginning of the real explosion of the pipelines and the fossil fuels. They're at the forefront of building for the Saudi royal family and all of these, you know, these great the first huge vast stores of oil that are discovered in these countries, and Bechtel's at the forefront. And then, you know, through Nixon, I mean, this is another California, you know, it's a California company, and Nixon's a California political figure, and George Shultz and Caspar Weinberger are both in the Nixon administration. They both go from Nixon administration to work for Bechtel, Caspar Weinberger as corporate counsel, and George Shultz as eventually CEO. And then, you know, as soon as Ronald Reagan comes in, which is again this impulse from the West. It's really, you know, the transfer of power from the Eastern United States to this kind of Western, which is a global empire with the eye toward the Pacific Rim. As soon as Reagan comes in, he taps Shultz for Secretary of State and Weinberger Secretary of Defense. And that was just the beginning. There were several other people in Bechtel that wove in and out of the Reagan administration as well. But that's when the lid comes off. There's no pretense that, you know, there was not a revolving door. And it was very difficult to see, you know, what Shultz was doing on behalf of Bechtel, or what Shultz was doing on behalf of the United States government, and where foreign policy started, you know, dovetailing, and the foreign policy of Bechtel sometimes was at odds with the foreign policy of the United States. The United States foreign policy under Reagan started tilting in a different direction, and the Bechtel mentality and foreign policy stance was very much an issue in all of that.
Right. I'll never forget, I ended up in 1989 being invited, or no, sorry, it was 86, I'm trying to remember, 86, 87, somewhere in the late 80s when Weinberger was still Secretary of Defense, I got invited to a briefing of industry leaders on the budget. They were lobbying for the budget, and I arrived, it was clear they just needed some token women. But what they had was CEOs of all the top companies, all the car companies were there. And essentially, you got a briefing on the budget, and what you realized is the entire industrial policy of the United States is being run through the federal budget, because all these companies are, you know, so the car companies are all making trucks and tanks for the military. And essentially, the strategy was hold the PEs of the stock high using government contracts, and then everybody runs around the world and buys everybody up. And, you know, and you could really sense the extraordinary interdependency between America's corporate infrastructure and the budget and the military budget.
Right. And I think that's what, I mean, I think my book is kind of a primer for that, because I'm certainly not, you know, I'm kind of a generalist. I'm not really an expert in any of these areas. And it was all of this research, you know, was as much of a shock to me as it will be to the reader, but it really is kind of a primer for how business is really done. I mean, I'm not an economist, and I'm not a, you know, financial writer, and so to come to it, and this is really about politics. This is probably more of an extension of my book, The Money and the Power, about the rise of organized crime in Las Vegas. This is really about, you know, how government works and how government and corporations together work, and it's a real eye-opener.
Well, The interesting thing is, if you look at the history of Bechtel's work, both for the U.S. government and global governments, you know, their growth as a business has really paralleled the growth of government debt.
Mm-hmm.
And a quote I keep using all year is from the German finance minister, who says, said it at the G20 meeting in Shanghai in February. He said, "The debt growth model is over."
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been growing government debt and using it to fund a lot of infrastructure and other big government projects, which is very much Bechtel's beat. And so the source, the financial source of their growth over many decades, is now in the process of drying up. And that's one of the reasons,
right,
I find it so interesting what they're up to, you know, sort of what's the plan now that,
yeah,
the debt growth model is over.
Well, I think it's really interesting. You know, I had I had no access to the Bechtel family or even any, you know, high-level corporate principals, and they're notoriously secretive, notoriously press-averse and media-averse. And but in response to my book, which they very much did not like, Brendan Bechtel, he's the fifth generation, 35-year-old fifth generation new leader of the company, and you know, he just gave a huge exclusive story to Fortune magazine. It's the first time, I think,
oh, really?
in five generations, yeah, that a Bechtel family member has given an interview, and he says even that it was in response to this critical book, and that they're really focusing. I mean, it mentions my book, The Profiteers, and the expose, and the that bashes Bechtel for operating a revolving door with government officials, and that they're spending, that their priority right now is really to repair the damage to the reputation that I have done, and other critics about their kind of government, their feeds from government contracts, and so they're asked a lot about, you know, going forward at a moment when the global collapse in commodities prices has forced, you know, oil and mining companies to rein themselves in, and projects, natural gas and copper mining projects all over the world are being put on hold, Brendan Bechtel says that he, you know, his company is going to be fine in this tough market because they've got such an advantage for being a private family-led enterprise, which is what his father,
right,
and grandfather and great-grandfather all insisted on being. And he even says,
right,
we don't have to please Wall Street. You know, our competitors have to take on risky jobs. We don't have to. And I think what you can also see from what I'm seeing from what is being said by the company, the stuff that they're putting forward now, I suspect that we're going to see Bechtel turning its attention away to a certain extent from the global reach and back home to, you know, I imagine that Bechtel's motto is going to be, you know, making America great again. I mean, I think you're going to see, well, depending on, you know, the outcome of the presidential election, but you know, Bechtel seems to fare equally well in a bipartisan climate. But I have a feeling,
right,
we're going to see Bechtel taking on the huge infrastructure projects throughout the country that, you know,
right,
I think there's going to be this kind of isolationist turn inward. And I think they're poised and, you know, kind of posturing to benefit from that.
Yeah, the infrastructure opportunity is astonishing in this country, both in terms of how much we need, but also the opportunity to now integrate new technology into infrastructure to make it much more efficient. So that wouldn't surprise me at all. So I'll check out the Fortune piece. So let's talk about Bechtel in San Francisco, because I've tried to understand, I've read snippets implying that Bechtel is literally controlling and running the internet backbone. I don't know if that's true, but I have an intuition that they've been very involved quietly in the growth of Silicon Valley, both the transfer of technology out of the black budget into Silicon Valley, as well as some of the hardware and some of the financing. But you allude briefly to it in your book. I was wondering if there's anything you could say about Bechtel's role in the development of the internet in Silicon Valley.
Well, you know, I did not really explore that, but it was certainly something that was on the fringes all the time, and they were very much involved. You know, they were partners with Google in various ventures, and very
right.
much at the, you know, very involved at the Stanford Research and at the Hoover Institution, and certainly at the forefront of a lot of what was going on in Silicon Valley. And then it's to all come kind of quietly, surprisingly quietly, but, you know, Riley Bechtel and George Shultz and Henry Kissinger, also a Bechtel consultant, they were, you know, they were on the board of this Theranos, you know, the blood company that is under such attack at the moment. And they were very much, in fact, there was some quote, I think, in the Wall Street Journal or somewhere, where basically all of these main, you know, this was a company that was valued at $9 billion a few months ago, is now valued at zero, and really got, also privately held, but really got its big bang through the support of the Bechtel, of Riley Bechtel and George Shultz. And their names have suddenly disappeared from, you know, all of the bad publicity now around Theranos. But
you know, Kissinger and Shultz are off the board, but Bechtel's still on the board. Riley Bechtel's still on the board.
He's still on the board.
Yeah, he's still on.
Well, yeah. The and you know, there's a lot of, I mean, again, it's very difficult to know because it's all privately held, so you can't look at the Bechtel Group, or you know, you have to take them at face value what they put on their website. Because they don't, you know, they don't give interviews except for this hugely laudatory one that Fortune recently got. And so, you know, whatever, you, even their earnings, you have to take at face value. And their private investments.
Well,
and
yeah,
as you know.
Well, they,
you know,
had a very, the family, the Bechtel family was separate from Bechtel, the corporation, but the family had a very significant venture capital arm. And when I was at Dillon Reed, we had an investment bank on Wall Street. The family venture arm was the one that invested in Dillon Reed in the beginning of the in the early
right.
80s. So
and Bechtel, the corporation, is the family also. But yeah, the and
right.
I think Shultz also had quite a bit of stock. He was one of the few outside of family members with stock in. I don't know if it was Sequoia that you were talking about or. The Bechtel Group, there was a Bechtel Financial. I mean, it's had several kinds
right.
of iterations,
Sequoia.
But again, in the Dillon Reed days, especially. But yeah, the Silicon Valley, I mean, that would be worthy probably of a whole other book. But the role, I mean, I know that they've been in, I would say that in addition to the infrastructure and the technological stuff that you're talking about, I would bet that we're going to see Bechtel moving forward in the national intelligence and intelligence gathering
right.
aspects of, you know, and I think that's one of the reasons that it's so important for them to kind of repair the image.
Right. So let's turn to the Iraq War, because there's no doubt that the Iraq War was an enormous, that Shultz and others in and around Bechtel were very aggressive in lobbying for the war. And the war was an extraordinary financial, the only word I know to say is boondoggle. I mean, when you spend $5
yeah.
billion dollars to build a hospital, that's quite
mm-hmm.
extraordinary. So what was Bechtel's role in the Iraq War?
Well, you know,
happened?
I mean, Bechtel, again, it's one of these ironies. I mean, Bechtel was involved in the, you know, in building infrastructure in Iraq as early as the 50s. And then, you know, was a strong supporter of Saddam Hussein for many years until it was no longer popular. I mean, I think you can always kind of tell the direction that
right.
foreign policy is going to be going in. If you look at what Bechtel's doing, and there's a great line, you know, first come the bulldozers, then come the ambassadors. So, you know, Bechtel's always first on the scene. So they were very active in building in Iraq long, you know, before, and then as soon as Saddam Hussein was no longer, you know, doing what the administration, what was in the strategic interest of the United States, then they became very involved in pushing for, you know, him to be overthrown. And then I mean, this is Schultz and Bechtel and Steve Bechtel Jr. And advise, you know, really very much advising President George W. Bush to overthrow him. And they were prepped, you know, they were on the scene in Kuwait preparing to go in and then get the first major contract to rebuild Iraq before Bush had even, started the war. So, you know, they had the inside track on that from the beginning, and it's one of those, you know, situations. We see it again in the nuclear field, but it's one of those situations where, you know, they probably built the palace that they then, you know, that we then bombed, that then they got the contract to go back in and rebuild.
I call it the break it, fix it model.
I've got
you break it, you fix it,
here.
Then you break it again,
yeah.
Then you fix it again.
It's a, you know, the mafia has a great axiom for that. But we see it again in the nuclear world where, you know, here they're being paid, you know, billions of dollars to manage the government laboratories through the Department of Energy. They're one of the largest subcontractors or contractors for the Department of Energy in the nuclear weapons labs. And then, you know, they turn around and some of their subsidiaries then sell nuclear weaponry, which presumably has been, you know, the technology that was developed at the government's nuclear weapons labs through the Department
right.
of Energy. They then turn around and sell, you know, nuclear-propelled submarines back to the Department of Defense. So then they're among the top defense contractors, too. It's like, wow, this is great work if you can get it. You know, it's like a double loop.
Well, you're basically paying, the government's paying you to learn all the technology that you then use to sell things back to them. But the biggest concern I have when you describe the layoff of all the senior physicists, or many of the senior mm-hmm. physicists, what you're talking about is the stripping the government of its internal intellectual capacity to govern or manage its
right.
most risky technology. And that, from a governance standpoint, that is suicide. To me, it's not privatization. It's a coup d'etat. It's
exactly.
It's frightening.
I think you're right, and
right.
and it's very, you know, it's a brain drain at the level that, you know, I mean, it's not, we're not talking widgets here. These are the bombs, you know. This is a nuclear arsenal that could destroy the world many times over. And, you know, I've gone around the country talking about this book, and I get the same question a lot of places where you know, and not always from hecklers, but, you know, if not Bechtel, who? And, you know, that's a legitimate question. I mean, if the United States is going to be meddling in every country in the world, you know, I guess we need a construction firm and an engineering firm to do it for us. But also, you know, these are powers and responsibilities that the government used to have on its own. I mean, this kind of, you know, the old, and obviously the technology is light years away from where it used to be, but the Army Corps of Engineers used to build things for the U.S. government. You know, the U.S. government built for the U.S. government.
Well,
and
in any governmental, yeah, in a governed system, you have enough capacity internally so you can hire and fire and manage contractors. You don't
right.
strip that governance and senior management capacity. And there's nothing wrong with having tons of construction firms doing lots of things for government, but you need a governance control structure which has information and intellectual capital sovereignty. And
mm-hmm.
that's easy to do. I mean, you know, it's not difficult to do whatsoever. And, you know, I can't fault Bechtel for this. I mean, George W. Bush should be absolutely taken behind the barn and shot for this. So...
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you're not talking about a privatization, you're talking about a coup.
It's not operating in a vacuum. I mean, obviously, it's had
right.
complete support of the government every step of the way. And also,
right.
you know, one of the striking things I found is that, you know, I thought I'd go into this, it's a multi-billion dollar profiting, you know, company, that, and I've been doing investigative reporting for, you know, since the 1970s, and I figured, well, there'll be tons of litigation. There'll be, you know, all kinds, and there's nothing. It's so empty. It's stunning that, you know, I thought, well, where are their competitors? How come Fluor isn't suing them for, you know, non-competitive practices or, you know, there are no rivals, and that gets back to what you said earlier. I mean, everybody's divvying it up. They're obviously, their power, Bechtel's power is outsized compared to the lobbying they do. I mean, Lockheed Martin, I mean, there's plenty of other companies that spend, you know, multi-millions more in lobbying and political contributions. It's almost like Bechtel doesn't even have to. They still get everything. They're at the front of the trough for everything. And when I started this book, I thought, wow, this is really going to be about this company that's kind of the corporate arm of the U.S. government. And by the end of it, I started seeing the U.S. government as the public policy arm of Bechtel rather than the other way around, because Bechtel doesn't only work for the U.S. government. Bechtel's relationships in the Middle East and South America and Africa and Indonesia sometimes, and China and Japan sometimes, are far stronger and more significant than their relationships with the United States government. So why is the United States government bending over backward to make sure, you know, that Bechtel's always taken care of? And I'm not
I would say Bechtel is a
I mean, yeah, I think Bechtel, all of this needs to be discussed.
Right. Well, the thing is that the history of Bechtel is they have been anti-capitalism. There is a great quote I used this weekend from a guy who teaches at Oxford, who used to be head of the Davos World Forum, and he said that the group all believed in government. Government was the solution, and you had government. You know, basically what they're describing is getting government to fund projects that their companies all do without a lot of competition, without a lot of market economics. And that's
and
the
no
problem.
Oversight. Right.
Right. And little oversight. I mean, I always tell the story, Sally, when I worked as the Assistant Secretary of Housing, I used to, we had a major defense contractor run all the payment and information systems. And I used to ask them for the core information, the data I needed to make sure that my operation was compliant. And they refused to give it to me, and there was nothing I could do. It took me 10 months of lobbying the White House to get things reorganized enough so that I had the core data I needed to know as to whether my operations were compliant or not. I mean, I could go on and on and on about the data beast. But the reality is, you know, the U.S. government is no longer sovereign. It doesn't have information sovereignty. It doesn't have financial sovereignty, you know, just as it's bad in the operations and constructions. So it's the same dependency you see on the New York Fed member banks. So I think that
It's further clouded by all of the national security aspects of it. That you know, I mean, I couldn't even get from the government. These are government contracts. I can't even get a straight answer how much these contracts are for. I mean, who were the contractors that built the gazillion-dollar embassy in Baghdad? That's confidential. It's, you know, it's classified. I mean, that has cost the taxpayers, you know, untold billions. And we can't even figure out, you know, we can't even be trusted to know who the contractors are. And Bechtel, I think, has more employees with classified clearances. Now, Bechtel, by the way, claims to have 50,000 employees. Most of those are subcontractors throughout the world. The company itself is relatively tiny. And, you know, and so, and they're riddled with, you know, security clearances and, you know, they don't have to answer any questions, and it really is a capitalism far more in line, as I write about, with cronyism than any kind of free market ideology.
Here to me is the question, because it comes back, there's a big conversation going on in the establishment about productivity and the absence of productivity. And the reality is, we're now in a situation, and you can see it coming through all the brouhaha on the campaign, you know, Americans don't believe, whether government or big corporations, that return on a shareholder is aligned with building the total economy. In other words, you know, I don't think anybody in America really has a problem with somebody getting gloriously wealthy if they make the pie bigger for everybody.
Right.
That, you know, it used to be what's good for General Motors is good for America. And now, whether it's what's good for the government or whether it's good for big corporations, you know, it's bad for America. It's making everything less productive, less trustworthy, you know, I mean, exactly. Look at the money that went missing on Iraq. Look at the money that went missing before Iraq. And that involves all sorts of people cycling in and out of Bechtel. So, you know, most Americans want to be highly productive, and they're watching this and they're saying, whatever this is, it's not a productive use of resources. You know, right. We're talking about something that has gotten way out of control and way not transparent and way not optimizing resources. It's very, very wasteful. And whether it's financially wasteful, and it's too bad, because if you look
and
at the history,
it's profiteering for a handful of people also. I mean, it's the difference between Warren Buffett and Donald Trump, you know. I mean,
unfortunately,
you know,
I could also tell you some things about Buffett too, but but here's the thing. We if the debt growth model is over, we have to get back to making sure we optimize precious resources. This country does need major infrastructure. Bechtel has a history of great engineering and great engineering accomplishments. We need that. It's not like we want that to go away, but it's kind of like get off the cronyism and get back on to doing things that are good for the whole.
Well, and you know,
they have the capacity,
which is always the big irony about Sally Denton. But that, you know, I have to believe that you've got this Brendan Bechtel who, you know, went to a small liberal arts college in the East, and he's 35 years old, and, you know, he's inherited this company, the legacy of his family for five generations, and who knows,
right.
You know, maybe there's a new generation here that can move forward in a new way, and maybe his, you know, goal as being, you know, being the first Bechtel to have any transparency whatsoever and to admit, you know, we took a really black eye from this investigative report, this investigative book by Sally Denton, and we're going to make sure they didn't. I mean, the old way of Bechtel doing things would be, you know, sue me, slam me, smear me, ignore it, you know, whatever. And that, you know, I have to admit that I kind of have taken heart at his approach that, you know what, you know, we've been attacked and maybe we deserved it. We're going to take a look at all this.
Here's the thing. America, I don't think that's naive at all. I think America has to get back to being productive if we're going to survive. The party's over. So we're all going to have to go back to, you know, it's funny, I had an investment bank in Washington, and we had a rule for every dollar we made, we had to be able to document and prove that we made 10 times that for the client. So we had to be able to prove that our return to shareholders, you know, produced a much bigger total economic return, and it all had to be clear and documented and transparent. And I think, you know, what I'm seeing by reading what you wrote, what I'm seeing is that once upon a time, my guess is Bechtel, you know, had that positive total economic return and has gone into a period when that's diminished or turned negative. And you certainly see that on the labs. You certainly see that on the Iraq war. And so the question,
well, I think the war is a key thing here. When you get so entrenched in the military so that you're, you know, the things that you're building for the military are the key, you know, so much depends on that, then all of a sudden you've got such a strong interest in making sure there are wars constantly going on. That's when the lines, I think, start getting really blurred.
Right.
And there was also a time, you know, the early Bechtels and the first relationships with national intelligence through McCone and the Dulles brothers, there was a time when, you know, it was kind of the gentleman's club, you know, just don't bother your pretty heads about what's going on and trust us to figure all this out. And that's the legacy of the Bechtels, that they really were part of that. And, you know, that world view isn't working anymore. And it's not working for America.
Right. And the question is, okay, so how do we get it back? And that's why I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen.
That sounds like your solution. You're the one who figured that out.
Well, no, but I, you know, first you have to have transparency. Because, you know, it's real funny. I used to have a pastor in Washington who would always say, God does not bless a mess. So we have a mess, and the question is, how do we get to where we need to go? requires transparency. And I think, you know, we're going to have to turn this one company and one government at a time. And that's why I think The Profiteers is really a marvelous case study in how the American economy has evolved from a time when we thought what was good for General Motors was good for America to, you know, some place, a time when we have, you know, whatever's good for Bechtel, we just assume it's bad for us. And
I
that's not good for anybody.
With you, and I wish I had understood that view for my epilogue, because I think that you're exactly right. That's exactly the transparency. Part of the transparency is accountability. And that's the, you know, that's why we've got these dangerous impulses in America today, you know, where there really is a search for a demagogue or somebody to figure this out, because nobody trusts anybody. And nobody trusts the corporations. Nobody trusts the government. And there's reasons. There are good reasons, obviously, for that.
Right.
So the only way you get that trust back is with transparency and accountability.
Right. I prefer engineers to demagogues. So my vote is Bechtel gets their act together. Because I don't want demagogues.
I need to go.
Need to go. So
I could talk to you all day.
Sally, great book, sallydenton.com. Read your you can sign up to follow your Twitter feed. Get Sally's books. You'll discover, you'll rediscover, fall in love with, and understand America arguably for the first time.
Oh, thank you. And
have a wonderful day, Sally.
Review it on Amazon, because there's lots of one-star reviews. I've got five.
Oh, really? I did a five-star on Amazon, but I'll make sure I put another one up. Okay.
Thanks so much.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.